intervention in the sedan and whether or not that would be beneficial. Our moderator today will be our very own Daniel Bebe, one of the Bigelow Fellows here.
Great, thank you, Veronica.
The U.S. says there is a genocide. The United Nations says no. But everyone agrees that there is a serious humanitarian catastrophe going on in Darfur at the moment. According to the United Nations and various non-governmental organizations, approximately 350,000 to 400,000 people have died, and over 2 million people have been displaced, living in various refugee camps in Sudan and in Chad. Despite the Darfur peace agreement and various United Nations Security Council resolutions, the killing continues. Going forward, there needs to be a discussion about the relevance of U.S. intervention in the area. In light of these events, we want to go forward to discuss the relevant issues here. Going forward, I want to talk about a couple things before we go into the discussion. First, Sudan has rejected the United Nations resolution to put peacekeepers in Darfur area. It has expelled the United Nations highest representative in Sudan. And finally, it has stated under no circumstances does it want additional peacekeepers and an expansion of the United Nations mission's mandate in Sudan. The United Nations mission in Sudan is there currently to supervise the Sudanese civil war. I have been asked to provide a general overview, a broad overview on the political, historical, and the legal framework governing humanitarian intervention. Obviously, that conversation would require quite a bit of time, and I won't be able to go through a comprehensive analysis. But I hope to give you a brief introduction into the relevant issues and hopefully give a broader context that will inform our panel discussion. First, a little bit about Sudan. Sudan is the largest country in Africa and the 10th largest country in the world by land area. It's approximately 39 million inhabitants. It is bordered by Egypt, Ethiopia, Eritrea, Uganda, Kenya, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Chad, and Libya. It has 39 million inhabitants, and the national language is Arabic, although 130 other languages are spoken. There's also a large multitude of different ethnic groups. Darfur is in the western region of Sudan, bordering Chad, the Central African Republic, and Libya. It's approximately the size of France and has 7 million inhabitants, although that number has changed given the displacement and the recent conflict. The main ethnic groups in the area are the Fur, the Masalit, and the Zagawa. Darfur traditionally has been a sultanate under various colonial powers, first the British and then the Anglo-Egyptian colonial administration. From 1650 to 1916, it had de jure autonomy, but it functioned underneath these colonial powers. In 1916, the British occupied Darfur and incorporated it into Sudan. It remained as part of Sudan and is now in what we conceive of present-day Sudan. In January of 1956, Sudan received its or won its independence from the Anglo-Egyptian colonial administration. It was purportedly a democracy, but it's been governed by successive military regimes. What's most important about this is the successive regimes have adopted the previous policies of the British and the colonial Egyptian administration when it comes to economic policies. In particular, it's focused the vast number of resources that Sudan has on the center as opposed to the periphery. What that means is that the resources of the state have been invested in Khartoum and in the provinces that run along the Nile, and not in the south and in the west. So an area, so Darfur, for example, is one of the least developed areas of Sudan in a country that's already underdeveloped. Two other things are important. These things have occurred since independence. First, during the late 1960s, there began a political discourse in Sudan that focused on a dichotomy between the black African and the Arab. This distinction is somewhat artificial. Many of the different groups have intermarried. Nearly all of the different groups are Muslim, yet this distinction was created some discord in Darfur. In addition, there were some regional geopolitics issues. Muammar Gaddafi was espousing an ideology of Arab supremacy, hoping to create a pan-Arab state in the northeast. These two factors planted the seed to create some discord that we're now seeing in Darfur today. So moving forward, in the 1980s, there were famines in Darfur. Approximately 90,000 people died in the famine of 84 and 85. During the early 90s, they were beginning to see agitation among the different groups for political and economic rights. These are the different groups in the West. In 2002, while the Sudanese government was focused on the second Sudanese civil war, which was occurring between the south and the north, two groups formed in the west, the Sudanese Liberation Movement and the Justice and Equality Movement. Both of these groups challenged the government, complaining that the government's policies favored Arabs over non-Arabs. They then, in 2002, began to engage in an uprising or a rebellion against the Sudanese government, attacking government outposts, military bases, police stations, etc. They were successful. At this point, the Sudanese government was engaged or beginning to engage in peace talks with the soldiers in the rebels in the south, and decided to change their strategy in the west. In particular, they pulled their troops and decided to arm the Abala, which are traditionally defined as Arab semi-nomadic camel herders who are indigenous to the area in Darfur and also crossing the Chad. These groups were armed with the goal of suppressing the rebellion in this area. This group was also known as now the Janjaweed, which is a Darfur term, which means an armed outlaw or bandit who's on a camel or a horse. The government supported the Janjaweed, which has systematically targeted the Four, the Masalit, and Zagawa, the dominant groups in the area, and also the key groups who are interested in exercising more political and economic rights in Sudan. So that's kind of the political and historical background. What are the relevant legal issues and policy issues here? First, there are two significant United Nations Security Council resolutions. There are more, but there are two that are particularly important. One is United Nations Resolution 1706, which allowed the United Nations to place 20,000 peacekeepers in Sudan. The Sudanese rejected this resolution. The language, the mandate, even in this resolution, was not to prevent civilian deaths by any means necessary, or to actually disarm the Janjaweed. It was designed to implement the Darfur peace agreement with the assumption that everybody wants to see that agreement implemented. If indeed that mandate is insufficient to stop the humanitarian catastrophe, what would be the next step? Well, the Security Council could act with another resolution to allow the UN peacekeeping force to have the right to indeed by force to disarm the Janjaweed and to protect the civilians. However, given one member of the United Nations Security Council, China has strong interests in Sudan and has suggested that it would veto such a resolution. So given that United Nations Security Council framework, what's next? Well, there's also a second resolution, which is Resolution 1646, which outlines the responsibility to protect. This is a doctrine that suggests that the international community has the responsibility to protect civilians from genocide and other crimes against humanity if the national governments are unwilling or unable to act. This is connected with the doctrine of unilateral humanitarian intervention. There is no exception in the United Nations Charter for unilateral humanitarian intervention. However, this has occurred before. There have certainly been interventions that break international law. And the question becomes, does the responsibility to protect doctrine create a legal foundation for a unilateral humanitarian intervention? Finally, even if it's decided that a unilateral humanitarian intervention is appropriate, there are three other questions to ask. First, is it feasible? Does the United Nations or the United States, for example, have the resources to go in and be successful? Second, is it politically sustainable? And then finally, what's the likelihood of the effectiveness of such an intervention? These are three issues, hopefully, that will be addressed by our panel, and that's something we should keep an eye on as we think about the broader context of these issues. Next, I want to introduce our panelists. To our far left is the Kirkland Analysis Professor of Law here at the Law School, Professor Eric Posner. He's published several articles with regard to contracts, social norms, cost-benefit analysis, and, of course, international law. He will be arguing against intervention in Darfur. To our immediate left, we have Professor Matthew Lippman from the University of Illinois Chicago. He's in the Department of Criminal Justice there. He's recognized as the nation's leading expert on the Nazi Holocaust. He's also very knowledgeable and published several articles regarding genocide, international human rights, international criminal law. He'll be taking a position supporting humanitarian intervention. And then to my right, last but not least, we have Professor Jadeh Nzebele from Northwestern University School of Law. He's also a former Bigelow Fellow, so we welcome him back. He's published several articles in international law and foreign relations law. And he takes more of a middle position, which he focuses on the political sustainability of any sort of humanitarian intervention. With that, I leave the floor to Professor Lippman.
want to thank you for the invitation. My father is a 1936 graduate of this law school, so I grew up with a very close relationship to law school here. Are you willing to pay the costs of non-intervention? At what point does that cost for you become too prohibitive? If you favor non-action in terms of intervention, what alternatives do you propose that haven't been, at this point, exhausted? Nicholas Kristof, columnist for the New York Times, great chronicler of Darfur, in New York Review of Books article, documents that during World War II, there were 6 articles on the Holocaust appearing on the front page of the New York Times. He said, today, it's different. We have a slow-motion genocide. We're very aware of what's going on. We know what's going on because of people like Kristof, who in February 2005 provided the first photographs of what's going on in Darfur in gruesome detail, including the immolated body of a young schoolgirl who had been raped and a skeleton whose pants had been pulled down. And he writes, if it's a man, he's been castrated. If it's a woman, she's been raped. And he quotes from a document directly from the Sudanese government stating that the demography of Darfur must be changed. And we know what's going on for people like Samantha Powers, who in The New Yorker writes of Rashida Abbas, who runs from a burning village. Her husband's been killed with 3 children, 2, one in each hand, one in her back. Her 2 young sons in front of her, Adam 5, Hassan 7. They're both ripped from her grip. The youngest one is thrown into the flames. The oldest one is shot. We know what's going on from the Washington Post, which documents the experiences of a woman, Fatima Ibrahim, who watches her cousins and brothers thrown into a burning pyre. And a man breaks out of the crowd and tries to stop this, and he's beheaded and dismembered. So these are the kind of glimpses that we have of what's going on today in Darfur. And of course, we know the Janjaweed, as stated, is directly under the aegis of the Sudanese government. They are paid, directed, trained by the Sudanese government. We're very much aware that they follow a uniform procedure of attack that's been documented by every NGO, every government study group, where they go into villages preceded by bombers, preceded by helicopter gunships, loot, rape, steal, burn, kill the young men, the women pushed into refugee camps internally within Darfur, Sudan. We know what goes on in those refugee camps. Increasingly, humanitarian aid workers are targeted. The Danish NGO that is in charge of humanitarian relief announced yesterday they're leaving, which will put 300,000 more people outside the reach of humanitarian relief. We have systematic rape by women against women who venture out of the camps. We have malaria. We have diarrhea. We have a shortage of medicine. We have 450,000 people in July were not serviced by food deliveries because of the situation in Darfur. This is the context within which in summer of 2004 there was a current House resolution that said that this is genocide, that President Bush referred to it as such, that Kofi Annan referred to it as such, and actually went so far as to say if the UN will not intervene, that the United States should take unilateral action. In September of that same year, Colin Powell testified before Senate Foreign Relations Committee in which he said this is genocide. This was based on a rather methodical study of the situation in Darfur, statistically based, revealing facts such as 80% of the villages of people that have been interviewed have been burned, 66% of the people have seen someone killed, etc. 33% of people had been seen killings have been associated with racial epithets. There was a target of these African-based tribes in Darfur. Now, Colin Powell went so far as to say, well, it doesn't actually matter that greatly whether we call it genocide or not. The important thing is that we act. Well, it was an important statement because the first time the U.S. has actually called an ongoing situation in the world a genocide. It is the first time that the United States invoked Article 8 of the International Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide and went to the United States Nations Security Council with this issue to be presented to the world community. The International Convention on the Prevention of Genocide is not just every garden variety of treaty. It is the first international human rights treaty adopted by the UN even before the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It contains a solemn obligation in Article 1 to prevent and punish the crime of genocide. This was moved out of the preamble into Article 1 at the behest of Belgium and India to make this a solemn obligation. It declares genocide the first international crime punishable in times of war and peace, which was an unprecedented statement. Genocide is one issue in which the world community recognizes the privilege to intervene. The African Union Charter recognizes the ability to intervene to prevent the crime of genocide or crimes against humanity or war crimes. So this is a seminal document in international jurisprudence. The UN has responded with a series of resolutions, as noted, set forth the basic framework initially of ceasefire, return of people to their communities, humanitarian aid, endorsed the African Union coming into Sudan. This was followed by a second document which established an international inquiry into the situation and augmented the sanctions that have been imposed, the arms embargo against militia groups in Sudan, with a statement that the UN would consider the boycott of the petrochemical industry in Sudan. This was then following the issuance of this report, by sanctions against four individuals that were integral to this conflict in Sudan and the conveyance of 51 names to the International Court of Justice for prosecution. What this suggests is, number one, that human rights of individuals is co-equal in importance to the world community in the United Nations Charter to the guarantee of international peace and security. And that is a significant recognition. Number two, the Millennium Document of the United Nations states that countries have an obligation to prevent and punish genocide and crimes against humanity within their borders. And the world community, through the Security Council, will act on a case-by-case basis to prevent and punish and intervene to prevent against genocide and crimes against humanity. And clearly, this Sudan has been singled out as an area of importance in which, as noted in the most recent resolution, the United Nations has endorsed intervention by a UN force under Chapter 7, which means an aggressive protocol for the military presence in Sudan, meaning confronting the Janjaweed, protecting UN and NGO workers, and guaranteeing the safety and security of the people of Darfur. Now, absent action by the UN, a strong argument can be made for unilateral or multilateral intervention by the U.S. This intervention would not be inconsistent with the norms of the United Nations Charter, and as noted, would be consistent with the obligation to protect, which has as a basic supposition that countries have an obligation and duty to protect human rights, that there is an accountability to sovereignty. It's not merely a privilege to be insulated from international accountability for your actions. The costs of non-intervention, obviously, human life between 200 and 450,000 people, depending on who you want to invest your credibility, have died. Up to 2.5 million people have been relocated. What does this say about the rule of law? What does this say about the credibility of the United Nations, which is now being threatened by a cluster of issues? What does this say about the spread of instability? Today in the New York Times, you'll note that 263 people have been killed in recent days as the Arab militias spread into Chad. In terms And lastly, what does this say about the basic values of the world community and if we're going to tolerate this action? The basic, I was thinking about today's talk and just conclude, saw a quote from Primo Levi, one of the chroniclers of the Holocaust, about Chaim Rumpalski, who was head of the Łódź ghetto in Poland. And I was contemplating this in the context that several days ago in China, the president of Sudan stated that only 10,000 people had died and that the notion that there was genocide going on was nothing but Jewish propaganda. And I was thinking about this in terms of the sense that Bill Clinton went to Rwanda following the genocide there and said, I really didn't know what was going on. There were people like me sitting in my office on a daily basis. I didn't realize it would go this quickly. I didn't realize 800,000 people would die in 3 months. And I'm thinking about this in the context of Nicholas Kristof writing that really, what's really most shocking is the fact that the world community has averted its eyes to what's going on in Darfur. What's really shocking is the fact that the best it can do is a slap on the wrist. Like Rumkowski, and Rumkowski traded off Jews for the safety and security of the larger community and kept trading them off and trading them off before it was too late. Like Rumkowski, we are so dazzled by power and money as to forget our central fragility, forget that all of us are in the ghetto, that the ghetto is fenced in, that beyond the fence stands the lords of death, and far away the train is waiting for you, for me, for the people of Darfur. Thank you.
So I was asked to talk about whether the U.S. should launch a military intervention in Darfur. This is a very difficult question to answer, and as circumstances change, one's opinion should change, and what I'm saying now is just based on my understanding of circumstances right now. Now, military interventions for humanitarian purposes have historically been extremely rare. In fact, arguably, there haven't been any. That is to say, a military intervention which has been motivated entirely by humanitarian purposes. Of course, some military interventions have had humanitarian effects. So just to take World War II, that had a humanitarian effect. The fighting by the Western Allies ultimately ended the Holocaust. But it wasn't the motive of any country initially to enter the war because of the Holocaust. And that's the general pattern throughout history. And I'll come back to that point. But for now, let me start by trying to give you a sense of the two main problems that afflict the notion of a unilateral humanitarian intervention. And I'm going to put aside the possibility of a multilateral humanitarian intervention authorized by the United Nations, since that seems very unlikely. So the first problem is just lack of public support for humanitarian interventions. Now, Americans, and I'm going to stick with America because that's the only country that seems even remotely likely to engage in a unilateral humanitarian intervention. Americans, like people in other wealthy countries, do care about what happens in foreign countries, but they don't care enough to be willing to spend significant resources to help people in other countries, and are especially reluctant to sacrifice the lives of soldiers in order to prevent atrocities in foreign states. Now, for President Clinton, the great evidence of this was the failed Somalia intervention of 1992-1993. That was begun by President Bush, but Clinton had to terminate it very rapidly when a little more than a dozen American soldiers were killed. The public at that point, which didn't know much about what was going on, but was generally supported the notion of providing aid to people starving in Somalia and using troops to protect the aid workers, immediately reacted by saying, "Well, you know, what's the point in being here? Why is this sacrifice worth it?" And Clinton didn't believe that he could make the case that the sacrifice was worth it. The troops were withdrawn, and Somalia remains a disaster as it was more than 10 years ago. Clinton, because of this, refused to intervene in Rwanda. He didn't think that Americans would support intervention during the Rwanda genocide. And then during the Kosovo intervention of 1999, which may arguably be a humanitarian intervention but really had other geopolitical motivations, he took extreme steps to minimize casualties because he understood that if there were too many American casualties, the Kosovo intervention would have to be ended. In fact, there were zero American casualties, at least among pilots, during the Kosovo intervention, and that was a success. The second basic problem might be called the problem of the law of unintended consequences. The Iraq war, if nothing else, has made clearer than ever the sheer unpredictability of warfare. People who are supposed to be grateful because they were liberated or saved turn out to be hostile. Suppressed ethnic, religious, and political conflicts surface and turn murderous. Neighboring countries see new opportunities to improve their regional positions and send in arms, advisors, and spies. And in general, small mistakes made by ordinary soldiers can have catastrophic consequences. Now, these are general points, and they don't necessarily, they don't suffice to show that a humanitarian intervention is unwise under all circumstances, and we have to think about the Sudan case in particular. So here are a few reasons for doubting the desirability of an intervention in Sudan. By the way, again, none of these are determinative, but they're all relevant. So the first is that Sudan is a vast country. As Daniel mentioned, it's the 10th largest country in the world in terms of land mass. So it's six times larger than Iraq, and it's about a quarter of the size of the United States. It has a population of 40 million, which is about half as large, one and a half times the size of Iraq's population. Now, no one thinks that if the U.S. engaged in a military intervention, the entire country would have to be controlled. Presumably, only Darfur or parts of Darfur would need to be controlled. Darfur is, as Daniel mentioned, the size of France or California, roughly. But that's still an enormous amount of territory. And the problem is that, as we see in Iraq, the U.S. has trouble even controlling very small areas, like, say, Baghdad, for example. If you try to control Baghdad, but you don't try to control any of the surrounding rural area, then people can go out into the rural area and come back and cause mischief. Not only that, because Sudan is so huge, logistics will be extremely difficult. Sudan's coastline is about 1,000 miles from the area of conflict. The closest friendly state is Chad, just over the border, but Chad has very severe problems of its own. Okay, second, Sudan has a powerful friend, China. China buys a significant amount of oil from Sudan and has been cultivating good relations with the Khartoum government for many years. China is likely to veto any Security Council resolution that authorizes military force. Now, of course, while this won't stop the U.S., right, the U.S. has used force in violation of U.N. Without UN Security Council resolutions several times in the past, including Iraq and Kosovo. The U.S. has very delicate relations with China and has been trying to avoid offending China for some time. So this is another problem. Third, Sudan is an unstable country. Sudan currently has a dictatorship. It does not have a history of stable institutions. As was mentioned, there's been a civil war raging on and off for decades in the south. There was a settlement in 2005, but that settlement is fragile. There's been a civil war in the east as well, and Sudan has had conflicts with many of its neighbors at one time or another. Now, you might think, well, this is good. This means that Sudan will be vulnerable to a military intervention and quickly fold. But a more alarming possibility is that Sudan will collapse like Iraq, and the civil wars which have momentarily stopped will restart. And these civil wars, by the way, have claimed millions of lives. Millions of people have died in these civil wars over the past decades. Fourth, Sudan is a poor country. Now, it's not as poor as many countries in Africa because it has substantial oil wealth, but it's still very poor. And as Daniel mentioned, it's suffered. There have been famines in Darfur as well as in other places. So here, the intervener has a difficult choice. It could go after Sudan's oil facilities, right, which will cause pain and maybe get the government to yield, but the result might be to exacerbate the poverty of the other people living in Sudan. Or it could spare the oil facilities, but in the process lose its strongest bargaining chip in dealing with the Sudanese government. And then fifth, Sudan is a Muslim country. A humanitarian intervention in Sudan, a military intervention in another Muslim country would be a propaganda boon for Al-Qaeda and its affiliates. It would be a disaster for America because whatever the motivations, the real motivations, people will believe that this is yet another example of how the U.S. hates Muslims and Arabs. The claimed humanitarian motive will be disbelieved in many quarters. So these are reasons for concern. Now, many supporters of an intervention imagine that an air attack would be sufficient. I mean, we've gone through this war after war after war. People say, well, it'll be a cakewalk. You have an air attack, bomb some facilities, the government will crumble. There is some precedent for this, namely the successful attacks in Kosovo and to some extent in Afghanistan, although both of those turn out to be more problematic than they seemed at first. But more likely, you're going to have to back up the air assault with ground troops, and then all of the problems that I mentioned come to the fore. Logistics, a possibly hostile local population, propaganda victories for the other side, and so forth. Now, against these points, supporters of intervention make the following arguments. First, Sudan's government, while ruthless, is also rational. And they point out that in the past, right after 9/11, when the U.S. government said that anybody who harbors Al-Qaeda members or otherwise supports them will potentially be attacked by the U.S., and the Sudanese government responded by reducing or eliminating its support for Al-Qaeda. So at least if pressure is put on the Sudanese government, you might expect it to respond rationally and try to stop the genocide. But the problem is just the sheer, again, the unpredictability of the motives of government. As we saw just recently with the invasion of Iraq, Saddam was rational, but he didn't break down, he didn't back down and reveal that he didn't have weapons of mass destruction. Well, why not? There are lots of theories. One is that he didn't know himself. Another was that he didn't want his enemies, like Iran, to know that Iraq no longer had weapons of mass destruction. So even rational governments have all kinds of considerations they have to take into account. Second argument in favor of intervention is that the Sudan has a weak military. It does. It has a very weak military, and there's no doubt that it would not be able to defeat the American army, possibly even a small American force. But Iraq doesn't have an army either, or it doesn't anymore, or it has a little army which is on our side, supposedly, and that doesn't seem to help us at all. In Somalia, there was no army at all. Somalia was a failed state with no army, and the U.S. went in and was basically defeated by these warring militias and insurgents, similar to what we now see in Iraq. So even if the Sudanese army collapses, American forces there would have to deal with people who are unhappy, militias, insurgents, just ordinary civilians who are hostile and may not be able to do that. That turns out to be much more difficult than defeating an army. A third argument in favor of intervention is that neighbors will help. Chad, for example, is an enemy of Sudan and would probably provide as much support as it could, certainly in terms of logistics, supplying air bases, and so forth. But Chad itself is a weak country. And all these other countries in this region, Ethiopia and Eritrea, which are often at war with each other, Libya, Uganda, they're also weak countries. And although it's an important point that this conflict could spread and weaken these countries further, it's also something that has to be kept in mind, that if the U.S. comes in and tries to get these countries to assist it, these countries might be weakened, right? The Sudanese might retaliate in various ways. And the final point is the never again point, which Matthew very eloquently made. How can the West say never again after every genocide and then fail to stop the next one? And I think the answer is, unfortunately, just that aspirations outrun capacities. Genocides are disasters. They're like tsunamis and earthquakes. They're very difficult to stop because they're enormous events. And when the process of trying to stop them might make them worse. Let me conclude now by providing you with three paradoxes of humanitarian war. These are, again, backing up to the more theoretical level, independent of Sudan. Why one ought to be, in my view, doubtful about claims that humanitarian interventions are justified. Again, this is not an analytic truth. This is just a reason for being skeptical, but skepticism can be overcome with sufficient facts and reasons. First, the first paradox is the size of state paradox. Some countries are too powerful to invade, and so when they abuse their citizens, the world has no choice but to watch. This was true, for example, with Nazi Germany until it attacked its neighbors. No country could attack Germany to stop the Holocaust. The country was simply too powerful. The Soviet Union killed millions during the 20s and 30s. Foreign countries could not intervene even if they wanted to. The Soviet Union was too powerful. And China, again, in the 50s and 60s. Nobody can invade a vast country that commits atrocities against its children, against its citizens. It's just too dangerous and costly. Less obvious than this is that many countries are too weak to invade. You invade them and they collapse. This is the case of Somalia, for example. It was already collapsed, but invading Somalia just made things worse. It may turn out to be the case with Iraq as well. An invasion can aggravate a civil war or even destroy a functioning government and cause anarchy just as bad or worse than the atrocities that one wanted to prevent. Second paradox, domestic political constraint paradox. A humanitarian intervention can occur only with the approval of the domestic population, the American public in our case. As I mentioned earlier, the public is altruistic enough to support intervention as long as it's not too costly in terms of lives and money. This leads governments to ensure that a humanitarian intervention will not cost too many American lives. This is the Kosovo example. And what Clinton did was he ordered the American bombers to bomb only at a very high altitude because he didn't want them to be shot down. And he had a good reason. He knew that if they were shot down in large numbers and pilots were killed and captured, the public would withdraw its support for the Kosovo intervention, the U.S. would leave, and things would be worse than they had before the U.S. had intervened in the first place. But the effect of ordering the pilots to fly at a high altitude was to cause bombs to miss their targets and kill civilians. And so the humanitarian goal, the humanitarian justification for the war, turns out to be weakened by the need to cater to domestic concerns. Final paradox, the security competition paradox. States that routinely violate human rights have few friends, and states that commit genocide generally have even fewer friends. They get isolated, and this makes them vulnerable to international pressure. But then there's this counter pressure, which is very unfortunate, which arises from just the nature of geopolitical rivalries. To the extent that the U.S. and the West cares about the genocide in Sudan, this gives an advantage to China. And China is not going to provide assistance or support or international legal legitimacy for any kind of intervention unless it can get something back, to get something out of it. And this forces the U.S. and the other countries to think about, well, what do we need China for? Do we need them against North Korea, for example? Do we have to make concessions to them with respect to Taiwan or their treatment of their own citizens? How does this line up with what we want from China in Sudan? So these are all the very difficult questions difficult reasons that make humanitarian war in general a bad idea, although again, there may be circumstances where it's both justified and feasible.
I feel a little bit like a sort of moral coward here, because taking the middle road is always the easiest road to take. But nevertheless, I'll try to be at least try to bring up some stimulating facts. And there are actually areas where I'm a little bit more even skeptical than Professor Posner's vision of things, that there are even more difficult problems with the Darfur crisis than one would think. And then but on a more general level, on the question of humanitarian intervention, I'm going to present some optimistic scenarios for Darfur too. Now, with respect to the idea of what a successful intervention is, think of it as a politically successful intervention. Think of a politician who decides to intervene today, whether it be President Bush or whatever the politician is, and they have to ask themselves, if I go in, how will I be judged in the future? Would I be considered a naive buffoon, or would I be considered a heroic, courageous feature? This individual, this is a sort of what a politician has to think of. What are the chances? And the reality is that it's a really complicated game. There is a significant risk that you can fail and look naive and look like maybe President Bush might look today under the Iraq intervention. That is, how would it turn out? Will we be embraced as heroes, or will we be castigated as oppressors? Now, with respect to intervention, it's actually a mixed story. There are many interventions that are of humanitarian quality where politicians have gotten a lot of traction out of it. Some of it has some, as Professor Posner mentioned, some of it was where humanitarian was sort of but a side benefit. Grenada was one, for example. Universal opposition in Europe, but President Reagan decides to ignore everybody. The Caribbean community was open for it. He intervenes in Grenada. He comes out. The public embraces it because there are these spectacles of American medical students coming back and kissing the ground, and public pride and public their public response was overwhelmingly positive. There are a lot of other contemporary examples. The British intervention in Sierra Leone. There were few British casualties involved. It worked out really well. The British were able to stop what was ostensibly a humanitarian crisis. There was, the Prime Minister Barrett received a lot of positive feedback in the British press for that, and the Sierra Leoneans embraced them. The Ecomog intervention in Liberia, right? There was an invitation for the Americans. That is one conflict, by the way, that if the Americans did intervene, they would have probably received a lot of support because there was already evidence. Liberians were on the streets screaming that they wanted Americans to be there. They were waving American flags. It would have probably not been very costly because Charles Taylor's military infrastructure was falling apart. When the Ecomog troops went in and intervened, when they succeeded, they were greeted with open arms, right? President Obasanjo of Nigeria and then his Ghanaian counterpart were able to walk in to Monrovia as heroes, right? And they received a lot of political capital from that. So it's not the case that every humanitarian intervention is risky. Right? They are, you have to think of in a case-by-case situation. We intervened in Haiti, right, during the Harris-Steed crisis, and we intervened. And it wasn't. There were not too many casualties, hardly any casualties at all. And that worked out. But there are problems with Darfur. One of them has been discussed at length here, which is the Chinese connection. And I will not belabor that point. But there is another point, which is, how will you be received? How will you be received? Will you be received as a liberator doing something good? Or will you be received sort of in a mixed way? This is where political sustainability is very essential. If people are not happy when you come in, right, then Americans are not going to be willing to be happy with you. They're not going to look at you as, the hero who went in to intervene. And there are problems with Darfur that should make us pause a little bit. One is that, unlike the way the conflict is portrayed, the Sudanese government and the Janjaweed have no rational interest to go in and just start massacring an entire ethnic group for no reason. There is a war. The Darfur region is represented by a whole slew of rebel groups. Much of what happened actually stems from an attack. The first incidents of violence was an attack by these rebel groups against military and police installations of the Sudanese government. A lot of these rebel groups are not pretty. In fact, one way the Sudanese government is ostensibly identified is a sort of as an Islamist sort of government. The funny thing is that the Islamic in the Islamist part of that government actually stems from one individual who's affiliated with the Muslim Brotherhood, a Sorbonne-trained Islamic scholar by the name of Hassan Turabi. He fell out with his government a couple of years ago in 2000. Hassan Turabi is a prime sponsor and leader of one and the most powerful of the Darfur rebel groups. It is a very, very militant, dangerous Islamic faction of that group. He uses the idea of a uniform Islamic Brotherhood that transcends race or background, right, as a sort of political justification to support this group. But it's not very pretty. And when you go into this kind of mess, what you see is not going to be a very attractive mess. There's also another component of what we should know about the Darfuri rebels. There have been ongoing ceasefire, right, agreements and proposals. In the last one that took place in May 2006, every single party who attended the ceasefire said, we can't believe the concessions that the Sudanese government made to the rebels. They have unilaterally granted so many concessions. Two of the rebel groups said, no way, we're going to walk out. It was quite understood in every one of these ceasefire negotiations and peace agreements, on and after again, they generally tend to walk out. I say this, and this is sort of an angle. The rebel groups here that have not been portrayed or described well in the foreign press They're sort of left in the background. They're not, as I said, they're not a very pretty entity. And there is a very big concern as to what they're doing strategically here. It may very well be that these rebel groups, and this is a strong concern, are exploiting this humanitarian mores that in the West, the idea that this will increase the chances of intervention and give them leverage. Some of their demands do not make a lot of sense. I want to frankly put it out there. Their demands are so harsh that it just would not make any sense for the Sudanese government to concede to them. One of those demands has to do with the fact that there is a shared resource agreement with the South. The South is a much bigger, there was a civil war between Northern Sudan and Southern Sudan. The Southern Sudan, right, the Southern Sudan North Sudanese civil war is a very extensive civil war that lasts more than 30 years. As part of the peace agreement that ended that war, one of the things the South got was a share in the resource agreements and a vice presidency, a permanent vice presidency. Much of this had to do with their size, their structure, the nature of this war, and how long it's taking place. There are some rebels who want a similar distribution to them. It's not the same scale. It's a sort of, it literally is almost like an extortionary racket. You gave it to them and we'll create a nightmare for you until you give it to us. We want a vice presidency, we want access to oil resources. I say this very, very importantly because we want to know, it's important to understand the incentives. If you go in to deal in this kind of situation, you intervene. You have to know that part of probably what you would have to do is not only disarm the Janjaweed, you would probably have to disarm these groups, you would probably have to face up to Hassan Turabi and all the various militants, right, and not so pleasant individuals who are sponsoring these groups and force them to come to the table. There's very little incentive that these groups seem to have shown that they want to do that. So this opens up to the idea that this could be a political nightmare if one goes in unilaterally. Now, what are the upsides? One upside that is never mentioned quite is that there are African troops in Sudan now. They're not doing very well. It's African Union troops. Now, something is going on here. One is that they're complaining that they don't have enough resources and they need a backup. What's put on the table now is an effort to supplement this force. Maybe have it under command of an AU commander. Something that would probably be presentable to the Sudanese. Now, if the Sudanese consistently refuse, they're going to likely lose two people or two groups that are somewhat supportive of them right now, sort of in a lukewarm, and that is the South African government and the Nigerian government. The Sudanese government probably feels that it cannot lose those two allies. When I say allies, that is they've been resistant to outright military intervention in Sudan. They want things to proceed diplomatically. Both of these allies are expressing frustration with Sudan, and this is a political opportunity. Why I say it's a political opportunity is a political opportunity not only that the Sudanese government may cave in, but that the Chinese may cave in. Because irrespective of the fact that Sudan is a prime Chinese destination for China, the rest of Africa even provides primer ground. South Africa Chinese have a lot of investments there, and Nigeria is also a strong source of Chinese investment. So what I'm trying to say is that collectively, the Chinese will have to make a decision as to what it is that they want to trade off, and this is where the opportunity comes in. Because when South Africa, Nigeria, and possibly Senegal and Congo, when I say Congo, I don't mean Congo, Kinshasa, but Congo Brazzaville, the leaders of all these countries have been very active. If they come down, Obasanjo in Nigeria has already said, I think a genocide is going on. So he's the first African leader to say this. He's signaling that he's getting frustrated with the Sudanese government. If they come down and say, you know what, we think we need to expand this African Union force, or we're not going to be on your side anymore, I think the Sudanese government will capitulate. And that's the opportunity you have. But that opportunity should not be unilateral American intervention. The focus should be on significantly bolstering, even if it's to a multinational force, the African Union troops there, and have their function be a protective function. They probably are not going to engage in what I would call hand-to-hand combat with the Sudanese government, but maybe just to provide a buffer around these refugee camps. That may be the best we can expect for now, but I think any other kind of massive intervention is probably likely to have more political problems than it solves, to create more political problems than it solves. And I think that's it. We're going to have a process where they respond. Is that right?
Yes. Okay.
I don't want to get bogged down in factual contentions We're talking about a no-fly zone as a first step. That would be incredibly effective in terms of limiting Sudanese military assistance to Janjaweed. You wouldn't have villages bombed. You wouldn't be moving troops around. You wouldn't have helicopters. We're talking, you know, we're talking about a multilateral intervention. We're talking, the peace agreement that was mentioned, with all due respect, is really wanting in many, many respects. Illustration, $30 million compensation for people that have lost everything in total. We're talking about millions of people, $30 million. We could go on. The African Union is there. There are UN troops in southern Sudan. UN troops, the UN has sent peacekeepers out on 23 separate occasions, at least since 1991. It's not a major innovation. What we're really looking at, just briefly, is a toxic mix. We're being intimidated by Sudan. We're being intimidated by China that's funding the oil industry in Sudan. That money is not getting to the people of Sudan. That is the issue here, that the Darfur has been starved economically. All the money is concentrated in Khartoum and that area of the country. Darfur is trying to get its fair share of that. We have tremendous profits being made by the Russians and Chinese selling arms. We have a reluctance to intervene in a fundamentalist Arab state, but the fact remains is if you follow the Arab press, there's great sympathy now for the people of Darfur, and the United States could do itself a great deal of good by intervening. More generally, what we have here today, with all due respect to my colleagues who did a really impressive job of presenting their cases, is a case study in denial. A case study that says genocide is a morally weighty term. We don't want to confront the fact that, once again, there are victims, victimizers, and we're bystanders. We don't want to confront the fact there are limits to our willingness to intervene, willingness to our altruism. We don't want to confront the fact that our notion of perfectibility of humankind is called into question. We don't want to confront the fact that our compassion is great for people that have already suffered genocide, and that our genocide and our willingness to intervene tends to be more political than a legally analytical situation. We don't want to confront the fact that we want to cast these as ethnic conflicts. Both sides are equally to blame. Intervention's too little, too late. The violence is inevitable. There's nothing we can do. That's what we want to be comfortable with. And we want to say, oh, these are regional, not international problems. These are humanitarian crises, not criminal conspiracies. And we're looking at a serial genocidal regime that has committed genocide in the north against the Nubian people and has committed genocide in the south against Christians, and is a violation of every single human rights norm in the world. And that's what we're confronting here. And it does no good to try and cast it in, you know, rhetorical reservations. We want to say, well, this is ethnic cleansing, this is a civil war. We want to deny these people the claim of genocide. In a sense, we'll go through any intellectual acrobatic possible to avoid the reality of what we're confronting and avoid a moral response. What we have essentially is genocide is symbolic rather than substantive. It's a victimless crime, metaphorically speaking. We don't have victims. We don't have victimizers. We don't have morally culpable bystanders. We want to confront the fact that the crime of the 20th century now is the crime of the 21st. And that is the issue. And how we conceive, how we configure this intervention is a matter for discussion. But the point is that President Bush himself has called this a genocide. And let me just make an important point, because this, and I don't want to belabor this, it's not true that the UN has not called this genocide. If you go and look at the Commission of Inquiry on Darfur, and you read that carefully, A, you'll see enough evidence to conclude this is genocide. And that was a very political move by the UN to avoid calling this genocide. But if you go to a very important paragraph, it says in that report, and if you read that report carefully in terms of the standard of proof that they required, it says that it is possible that people in the Sudanese regime are committing genocide, but this will be for a court of law to determine. And it says that Sudan is either in complicity with genocide, or secondly, officials in the Sudanese government have failed to prevent genocide. Now, I don't want to get into an elaborate discussion of the evidence and proof, but I just want to say that it is not true to say that the UN has refused to label this genocide. And beyond that, we can go through a laundry list of groups that favor intervention and recognize this as genocide, including our own government. And let me just say, if you didn't get into, there are enormous, we have very effective embargoes and freezing of assets on the Sudanese regime. As a matter of policy, this country does not have economic relations with Sudan, and that's a whole other discussion that's probably relevant to what's going on in this campus today. Thank you.
I thought I would just waive my response so that there'd be time for a few questions from, or did Jay want to say?
No, it's the same thing.
All right, well then let's open it up to questions.
If anyone wants to answer this, it's fine. But taking as an assumption that states are inherently self-interested actors, I was concerned about the interplay between politics, whether or not we had a Democratic administration or a Republican administration suggesting intervention, and how that would play out. It seems as though a Republican administration is more likely to garner domestic support, at least a Republican administration similar to Bush, because we have more self-interested motivations put out on the table to defend intervention. However, a Democratic president, and this is obviously, you know, generalizing significantly, but maybe might receive better internationally in terms of just the genuineness of the motives, however domestic support may be lacking. I was wondering if anyone thought this was accurate or if there are other considerations that we should take into account politically.
I think the politics are interesting. I guess as a general matter, my guess is it doesn't matter whether it's a Democratic or Republican administration. The presidents generally are too cautious to want to intervene militarily. What made the Somalia intervention unusual was that it occurred just at the end of the Cold War. So the U.S. seemed, super powerful and dominant and so forth. But as time passes and other countries, especially China, become more powerful, I think presidents generally will be cautious. And if the case can be made for intervention, either because there are additional goals aside from humanitarian goals, such as regional stability, in the case of Kosovo, or it can be done at a very low cost because the country in which the intervention will occur is very weak or what have you, then I think probably Republican presidents and Democratic presidents would intervene in equal measure. So I'm not sure there's much of a political difference.
Go ahead.
I'm curious about your point about this potentially being a propaganda tool for Al-Qaeda because of the fact that you've got a Muslim government in the Sudan. I wanted to know what your thoughts are. I know that since many of the victims in Darfur also happen to be Muslims, that there's an opportunity to sort of play the other side, to actually win support by maybe not through military intervention, but through other means of intervention, perhaps providing economic assistance to the African Union or something like that, to make the statement that, look, we will help oppression against Muslim victims in addition to fighting against Muslim governments. So I just want to get some of your thoughts on those issues.
Sure. I think economic assistance and diplomatic assistance and support for the African Union, I mean, it's hard to criticize that. And I don't have any problem with that. I think military intervention, where bombs come and blow up children, that's going to look bad. And if you look at Iraq, it's just like Iraq. The idea was, the Muslims are going to be grateful to America. Look, here's America comes and overthrows a dictator who's been committing genocide and has been torturing and abusing his own citizens, all of them, most of them Arabs and Muslim, and virtually all of the Muslims, right? And that hasn't been the effect. And what many of Jadeh's comments should make you extremely concerned, because if there is this great battle between more and less extreme Islamicists and moderates and so forth. That's again another place for jihadists to come and get their stripes and kill Americans and kill other people, kill the people the Americans are trying to protect, kill the people who want the Americans to come. It seems to me the sort of the religious dimension and this political dimension seems to me extremely troublesome.
Can I just throw in, when you look at the intervention and the recent intervention in Iraq and compare it to what occurred under Bush Sr., one leverage that Bush Sr. had is that he was able to get key Arab allies on board. Unfortunately, I mean, given your depiction, they've already sent the political signals very strongly. Pakistan, when they have served in the United Nations Security Council, members of the Arab League have taken a position that intervention and military intervention in Sudan is not what they want, right? So they sent out a strong signal that, look, we don't want folks here doing this kind of work. So if you want to say what unquote the Arab political voice is, it seems to be, at least at this stage, that they don't want intervention. So when you, with respect to political capital, I think United States stepping over all of that and intervening, you're more likely to get a situation you have, I think, today in Iran, which is that you won't have what I would call the pre-commitment by these other sort of supposed, you know, allies on board. And I think they've been very resistant thus far. So I don't think that bodes well.
Al Jazeera did have an editorial yesterday stating where is the Arab voices on this issue. Muslim voices on this issue, and there are talks now ongoing between Egypt and the Sudanese regime about a Muslim presence as an intervening force in the country, and I think that that's probably a very productive direction to be looking at. And I do think there are some public relations opportunities there in terms of intervening to protect Muslims and more generally to reposition ourselves in Africa, because the Chinese presence there now has really overshadowed the U.S. quite significantly.
We'll take one more question, and then after that, I want someone to talk to you about what's going on campus in regard to Gulf War. There's someone from the University of Chicago's chapter, Stan Becca, she will talk after. But we'll take one more question. There is another question.
One thing that I just have a really hard time understanding is that, you know, the one hand we have, people make a statement that, you know, this is a genocide, and there does seem to be some genuine concern on the part of the American government that about what's going on in Darfur. And I understand the concerns about military intervention, some of the real problems that poses, but why has there not been more, humanitarian assistance? Why has there not been more financial assistance, especially with the refugee camps in Chad, supporting the African communities, at least to protect the refugee camps in Chad and to supply and support those? It seems like that'd just be an easy way to at least give credibility to our concerns and to at least do something about it.
What would say the U.S. is the greatest financial contributor to humanitarian assistance, far outpacing any other country. I think there's a fundamental problem with relying on the African Union. I think that they are merely a symbolic presence. I have to be skeptical about their motivation at times. No one wants to give them money because they basically have been under the direction of Sudan, and they're viewed as ineffective, and they've been very reluctant to act aggressively, and I think that people had hoped that that would be a successful strategy. I agree, in theory, it would be nice to rely on them. I just don't think that anyone has confidence in their commitment and willingness to be involved as an active guarantor of the safety and security of people in Sudan. And in addition, I have to remember the Sudanese government initially limited them to 700 people, and now they're up to about 7,000. It is basically the equivalent of one police officer for the city of London in terms of territory. There just hasn't really been strong. Sudan really has not tolerated a strong African Union presence.
I was just going to say, quickly in response to that also, I do think there are a lot of incentives for the African Union, right? Darfur is now
sort of coming to the fore in the African Union. People are now pointing hands. People are pointing to the president of South Africa and said, look, you claimed that this new institution that you set up was going to be a different institution and that you would care about governance, right, and you'll be a ringleader. And to give South Africa credit, they've done a lot of work. What they're doing in Burundi now has been great, right? They have essentially probably prevented another Rwanda from unfolding, right, with their negotiations in Sun City in South Africa. The South Africans do have a strong commitment that this should be negotiated, right? I mean, that there can be some military intervention, military presence in the background, but it probably shouldn't be used. Now, I do think with enough pressure, and I think that's the kind of strategy that is being taken today, with enough pressure, the Sudanese government will agree that more Western resources, because they've been resistant, right? That's part of the problem, should come in, and maybe that the African Union forces should be supplemented. But one of the things that they may insist on, if that all works out, is that the entire command be under an African, even if you have, let's say, Pakistani and Indian troops and other Muslim troops involved, that it be under an African. They're very, very key up on that. And I do think there's some promise there. And I think that is probably, this is my opinion, the most likely vehicle under which this would probably, that's what's going on in the Security Council now, that's what they're considering, that's what they're trying to get the Sudanese government to agree to, and so that's going to be the most likely outcome. And I think it's an optimistic outcome, with a small O.
Well, joining, thank you, the panelists.